Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the editor of Vogue, Alexandra Schulman. Think of a fashion-forward, deadpan, stick-thin, couture-clad style maven, and then think again. In spite of being in charge of our leading style bible for more than 20 years, she has built her reputation on being, well, normal. She thinks designers cut clothes too small, she refuses to let superstars have photo and copy approval. Indeed, when she was first appointed editor, she'd never even been on a fashion shoot. Yet during her tenure, Vogue's circulation has increased. Her first job as editor was with the men's magazine, GQ, and she's had spells at Tatler, the Sunday Telegraph, and writing a weekly column for the Daily Mail. She says, "Vogue is not my personal taste, really. I think of it more as a kind of newspaper, reporting on what's out there." So, Alexandra Schulman, if style is a simple way of saying complicated things, what are you saying to me today with what you're wearing?
Well, I've got a rather kind of vivid sort of lime greeny top, which is saying, hey, it's sunshine out there. And, well, I'm quite a kind of smartly dressed woman because I'm wearing a kind of knee-length skirt. And I've got a bit of a kind of modern heel rather than too much of a kind of kitten heely look on. So I've got all kinds of messages in my clothes.
And do you subscribe to that notion that actually when particularly a woman getting dressed in the morning, but I suppose a man too, is sending subtle signals to people who understand the language about who she is and what she stands for?
Oh, completely. I mean, I had a lot of thinking about what I was going to wear today, even though I'm on the radio. I think that people make very conscious decisions about the way they want to portray themselves. And even if that's to say, I don't care about my clothes, you're still saying something.
When you came in today, you were full of joy. You're looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I've been waiting 55 years for this.
Well, your time has come. I mentioned in the introduction that you upped the circulation. It is interesting to note, though, that the circulation is relatively small. It's around about 200,000 copies, is it, a month that you sell?
It's about 200,000.
The money that you make is made on advertising. What do you tell your advertisers the typical reader is like?
Well, I think one of the great things about Vogue and a lovely aspect of editing it is there isn't a typical reader. And we're kind of an industry newsletter. We're a magazine that a girl of 14 will buy and a woman of 80 will buy who want to feel that they know what's in fashion, that they know what contemporary style is. And it's a magazine that I think has survived for its 97 years because of that kind of breadth of appeal.
What do you do to relax when you're not looking at photographs, deciding about graphics, having conversations about advertising? When you're at home, what do you do?
Well, I find relaxing incredibly easy. I run, I spend a lot of time with friends, cooking for them or going out with them. I read a lot, play a lot of music. I can compartmentalise and I'm able to think, I'm not going to think about this problem until 8 o'clock in the morning and then I will give it my total attention.
What a useful skill. We're going to turn to the music, Alexandra Schulman. Tell me about your first disc today. What is it and why have you decided to put it on your list?
Well, I think anybody of my generation really has to have a David Bowie going with them to any desert island, and Drive-In Saturday reminds me really of being about 15 and just starting to know boys in London, and it was kind of the soundtrack really to that summer.
It's a crash course for the ravers. It's a Drive-In Saturday. was David Bowie and Drive on Saturday. So let's find out a little bit, Alexandra Shulman, about the atmosphere of working in a place like Vogue, indeed being in charge. We think we know it from The Devil Wears Prada. I imagine that is nothing like your day-to-day working life at the office. What is the atmosphere like?
Well, it's hard if you're running the show. You don't really know what the atmosphere is like. You have to talk to the interns, really. But right. I think on the whole, given that I do talk to them, it's quite a collaborative, friendly atmosphere. Having said that, it's very intense. Most of the people that I've hired there are really talented, and you don't get really talented people all working together without quite a lot of, in quotes, creative tension.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of voices, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of kind of debate about everything.
And is it full of sort of racks of couture that's been flown in from Milan and shoes from Jimmy Choo? And do people all look rather sort of
well,
glamorous
and high-end?
Well,
there's a lot of racks, that's for sure. There's right. a lot of racks everywhere. Too many racks, not enough space. But, yeah, you know, there are incredible clothes, bags, jewellery. The girls, mainly girls working there, women, they do look pretty fantastic, I have to say. They've all got great style and taste.
And there really is there a dressing up cupboard where if somebody's going to a fancy party, they can go into it and say, I will have that Hermes bag. And, oh, look, there's a little Chanel jacket.
No, there's no dressing up.
Is there not?
No, absolutely not. Nobody's allowed to borrow stuff off those rails.
How very disappointing.
It'd be a firing offence.
Of course, we know that as much as it is very glossy on the outside, the fashion industry, it is also plagued by, well, what seems like a rather tarnished underbelly at times. You know, sweatshops being used to supply the great big chains on our high streets. Models we occasionally read dying from anorexia. Rumours that drug taking is rife. What do you make of that dark underbelly?
I think everybody is really very aware of trying to look at these issues and to improve the situation. I mean, it's something that I don't see. I've never been on a shoot and seen millions of drugs, or indeed any drugs there, actually. I'm not even drinking a glass of wine, for heaven's sake. But I also think that fashion is a very easy target, because as soon as somebody wants to talk about eating disorders, what will they do but put a picture of a model on a catwalk show on their front page? Because a beautiful girl in fashion sells papers.
It's interesting that you mentioned anorexia, because of course you're constantly asked about it, but it is relevant insofar as the images that young women are fed are relevant to their sense of self, to their mood about their self, to their idea of what it is they're aspiring to.
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because I'm literally at the moment working on a short film that we're going to send out to schools to make young women understand that we are creating a wonderful imaginative construct, but we are not photographing reality. And it's 6 hours of hair and makeup, £30,000 worth of lighting and styling and photography and post-production work that turns her into this image. I mean, the issue comes if some people, vulnerable people, can't look at those pictures and then see it as that, but try and judge themselves. That is a problem.
Let's have some more music, Alex. We're on your second. Tell us about this, Joyce.
Bongo Bong by Manu Chao. I first heard on holiday when my son was young, and just the second we heard it, we were like dancing up and down. And it's always been a song that I've associated with Sam, who is my most precious thing. And I'm very, very pleased that he still likes it now, even though he's a totally cool and very music savvy 18-year-old.
Hear me when I come, baby.
King of the
hear me when I come. They say that I'm a clown, making too much dirty sound. They say there is no place for little monkey in this town. Nobody like to be in my place instead of me, cause nobody go crazy when I'm banging on my boogie. I'm the
king of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come, baby.
King of the bongo.
That was Bongo Bong by Manu Chao. So, Alexandra Shulman, you were born at the end of the 50s, 1958, and you lived in London's Eaton Square. Sounds quite posh. Was it quite posh?
Eaton Square was and is very posh. The flat we lived in It was a two-bedroom flat, which my parents kind of carved up in order to have three children and a live-in nanny. It's all to do with my father. My dad was Canadian. He came over as a member of the Canadian intelligence in the war and never really went back to Canada. And he arrived somewhere in the centre of London. And basically, once he saw Eaton Square, that was where he wanted to be and where he insisted on staying. And it mattered very much to him. He was a theatre critic, and it meant that it was very easy for him to get to the West End every night.
And you said he was a theatre critic. He was the theatre critic. He was Milton Shulman, who wrote for very many years for the Evening Standard. He was 7 minutes from the West End. Did the West End come to you? Did you have all sorts of glamorous people coming through the door?
No, we didn't have glamorous people coming through the door. Both my parents worked extremely hard. You know, my mother was one of the first women ever to work in Fleet Street, worked full-time and was a mum. My father worked full-time and he'd go to Elvino's in Fleet Street and then he'd go out to the theatre and then he'd have to come home at 10 o'clock, have something to eat, and he would file overnight.
Did he write it in the newsroom or did he come and write it at home?
No, he came home.
So you would hear that, would you, on the typewriter in the small flat?
We were brought up to the soundtrack of the typewriters. Both my mum and my dad were always on typewriters, yeah.
And your mother is Drusilla Bayfus. As you were growing up, did you even notice that mummy went out to work and that was different from other girls' mummies, or was it just, that was just life?
Oh, I completely noticed that my mum went out to work. And not only did I notice, but I actually said to her endlessly, which I now see must have been so annoying. You know, I'd always say, I can't understand why you've created this life for yourself that's sort of so difficult. You know, you get up in the morning, you go out and you get food, then you come back, then you rush off to work, and then you come back, and then you do more work, and then you cook us dinner. You know, why do you do it? And now, of course, I do exactly the same thing.
What did she say to you when you said that as a little girl?
She kind of said, well, it's just the way it is. For instance, I forget which one of us it was after, but literally 2 days after she'd given birth, she was typing an article in her hospital bed on a typewriter. And she absolutely felt, you know, you couldn't expect to keep your job if you kind of made a fuss about having had a baby. But I would say that she would be the first person to say that not for an instant would she have not wanted to be a working woman.
Let's have some more music. It's your third one. Tell us about this.
Chips with Everything by Barbara Kay. We had a gramophone in the sitting room at home and my sister and I used to play it all the time. And Nikki and I are, I should think, literally the only two people probably in the whole world that can sing every word. And I haven't heard it for at least 45 years.
He can't buy me. Can't afford a Jaguar. He don't smoke a big cigar. Buys me half pints at the bar. But he makes me feel so good. I forget about my food and it's chips. Chips. Chips with everything. Chips. Chips.
That was Barbara Kay and Chips with Everything. Never mind Chips with Everything, Alexandra Shulman. Is it true that in assembly you were once told in front of the whole school that you weren't allowed potatoes with anything? Is that right?
It wasn't assembly, it was lunchtime.
Right.
But it was true.
What happened?
My mum, I think I must have been about 10, was worried that I was getting really podgy. And so she said to the headmistress of our school, can you make sure that Alexandra doesn't have potato, because we'd have the most delicious mashed potato. I can still see it now in a Pyrex bowl with that pool of butter soaked into the middle of it.
Delicious.
To be on the table at school. And I loved mashed potato. Anyway, for some reason, best known to themselves, they thought to announce this fact in front of everybody in the dining room rather than just quietly to me. But I've survived.
So you went from your primary school to St Paul's School in London. How did you get on, not in the dining hall, but elsewhere?
Well, I went to St Paul's having got in from the mashed potato primary school as being one of the sort of successful people in the class there, and arrived at St Paul's where there were 70 very bright girls from schools all over London, and was kind of promptly relegated to kind of third division in everything, which didn't play very well, I suppose, looking back with my kind of psychology. And I wasn't an academic success there. And when my parents went to one of the sort of parent teachers' evening and my mum asked my English teacher what she would recommend, you know, I did as a career, she said she thought I might just about get a job if I worked in a kindergarten, which is no offence to people working in kindergartens, but it wasn't at all what my mum had thought she was going to get out of this very kind of high-powered girls' school.
And you said that it didn't really fit with what was your kind of psychology. Tell me more about that.
I think I'm somebody who flourishes on success, but if I feel that I'm a non-starter, then I'll just give up and move on. I'm also probably intensely competitive and therefore won't compete at things that I don't think I stand at least a chance of winning. But I now realise that my intolerance of not being successful at something that I want to be successful at is very slight.
Let's have some music, Alex Shulman. Tell me about the next one. We're on your fourth choice of the morning.
This track here combines two of my favourites. It's Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, sung by Joan Baez, but written by Bob Dylan. And this song I first heard in southern Italy. It was one of the first holidays I went on where we were kind of children and adults and everyone was all kind of meshed together. And every time I listen to it, it reminds me of the feeling of future, I think.
Joan Baez singing Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. So, Alexandra Shulman, I need to know more about how you looked when you were younger. If I'd met you when you were 18, what would I have seen?
You'd see a sad-eyed lady of the Lowlands. and definitely a bit of Joan Baez, because I had very long hair and I was always in a kind of moo-moo or kind of caftani thing, you know, sort of relatively hippie looking. So I was definitely channeling Joan at that point. Yeah.
You went to Sussex University. You read social anthropology. Did you have a good time?
I was forced by my dad and my mum, actually, to go to university because my mother hadn't been to university. And the one thing that they were absolutely determined to do was for us to have a very good education.
Did they never say to you, you should do what we do, because we love it?
No, they both wanted us to be journalists.
Did they?
Really, yeah, yeah. My dad, you know, literally on his deathbed, his last thought was, you know, what better life could you have than being a journalist? And I'm very aware that I've lived through a fantastic period of being a journalist. That ability to experience and gain information and then impart it to others is, I mean, it's a great privilege. You might be reporting from a war zone or you might be reporting from a fashion show. But, you know, what a luxury to be able to experience something and tell other people about it.
Your first job in publishing, I think, was a secretary. And you worked your way up gradually through the ranks and you ended up at Tatler in 1982. And that was the same time as we really had the birth of the Sloane Ranger. So when you pinned on your Butler and Wilson Diamante brooch...
I had that.
Had you, yes. And you went out for the evening. What sort of evenings out did you have?
I went out a lot when I was in my 20s. And now I just think, you know, how did I get into work the next morning? Because you'd kind of, you know, you'd go off to a private view in London, be a gallery that would be opening, and then you'd go maybe to a book publishing party, you know, and you'd have a couple of glasses of wine there, and then if you were lucky you'd meet up with some people and they'd all say, you know, let's go to Zanzibar or the Groucho Club or whatever, and you'd all end up in a huge table there, and you know, at midnight you might go home or you might go on to one of the kind of one night clubs that were popping up all over London and dance and drink more. And I do remember that I was one of the few people that I sort of hung with at that moment, the few women who actually had a job to go to the next morning. And I do remember always being one of the first people to leave, you know.
You were features editor then at Tatler. What sort of pieces would you be commissioning and writing?
I got a lot of articles, big features to write, not about world famous people, but more about kind of figures around the London scene. And then I'd commission pieces that were social observation, really. You know, what was everyone eating, drinking, wearing, talking about, and make a story out of it. And in fact, that's still really the kind of journalism I really quite enjoy doing.
Let's have some more music, Alex Shulman. What are we going to hear? Your fifth?
Chelsea Hotel number 2 by Leonard Cohen. I love this one because, as he says, it's about the workers in song, and it kind of always makes me think of that still slight desire to be part of the music industry.
You were talking so brave and so sweet, giving me head on the unmade bed, while the limousines wait in the street. Those were the reason that was New York. We were running for the money and the flesh, and that was called love. For the workers in song, probably still is for those of them left.
That was Chelsea Hotel number 2, sung of course by Leonard Cohen. So, Alexandra Shulman, the 21 years then that you've been in charge, you're always, when you are written about, in the same article, in the same breath, Anna Wintour is written about. You see, you smiled even before I said that. You knew what I was going to say there. You are sort of regarded by people as the anti-Wintour. You know, she is famous for being this rather certainly flinty-looking character. You know, she's in these tiny little Oscar de la Renta outfits. And does it cheese you off that her name is always brought up alongside yours?
It makes me laugh more than anything else. Sometimes I've thought that maybe I'll write a book called Would Anna Do This, when I'm sort of doing something like feeding the cat or something. I've actually found Anna incredibly supportive and I like her. And I find it odd that, having been editor of the magazine for 21 years, that people still look at me and say, how can you manage to be editor? Because it's like, well, I am what editor of Vogue in London looks like now.
Do you think that's what they think?
Whenever people come in and interview me, it's always the thing that they always start saying or write about. But, you know, everybody does their job in their own way. And, you know, we all have our shtick.
What about the power that you wield? I mean, every superstar wants to be on the cover of Vogue. Do you have stars kind of oiling up to you and you think, oh, yes, I know what they're after here?
No. I mean, I'd love to say that Angelina Jolie is constantly on the phone begging to be on the cover. But no, it's not like that. And I think that the cover has become a kind of endorsement. And all kinds of people feel quite strongly about who's on the cover. When, for instance, I first put Victoria Beckham on the cover, there was quite a lot of kind of fuss about the fact that Victoria Beckham was deemed to be an appropriate person to be on the cover, whereas now she's been on covers of Vogue all over the world. And I mean, that's what's the sort of glory of editing the magazine, because you do have that power and people do pay attention to you, and you can use it, but you're also trying to use it to make statements about what you want to do with the magazine and intent. You also use it because if there's a very popular actress who's coming out in a movie, you're going to try and get them because that's going to sell copies. So you're sort of trying to do different things with each issue, really.
Does it feel good, the power?
Yeah, power's great.
Let's have some music. What are we going to hear now? We're on your sixth.
Leaving New York by REM. This song I like because I've become a runner and there's nothing I enjoy more than plugging, you know, the headphones in and running. This track always just, you know, it's a bit of a kind of power surge when it comes on.
Leaving New York, never easy. Tried to take, but loneliness, it wears me out, it lies in wait. And on our
That was R.E.M. and Leaving New York. So, Alexandra Schulman, you were a mother to a teenage son. You've been a stepmum too, to a stepdaughter. Let's talk a little bit then about your family life. How has being a mum worked with, well, a lot of the time actually being a single mum? How have you managed to work it in with such a high-profile and high-powered job as being editor of Vogue?
Well, I think you just are a mum, aren't you? As soon as you have a child, you're a mum. It's hard for me to say how.
Well, did it make it better in a way? Did it make doing the job better? Because did it give
Absolutely.
You a sense of proportion about the job?
Absolutely, 100%. Moment I had Sam, everything in my life became better, actually. Certainly work, because you were able to have this other thing that was just more important. Always, you know, I'd have a terrible day at work. Maybe there'd be some problem with some designer who hadn't liked a picture we've shot, or an article would come in and it was completely wrong, and then I'd have two people in the office wrong with each other, and I'd come home and, you know, and there would be my child, and he wasn't interested in that, and I was able to immerse myself in him, and still, actually, poor thing, still am. I also had Emma, my stepdaughter, living with me from when she was 12. So I had nice other life going on.
Your partner now, and has been, I think, for the last decade, is the writer and journalist David Jenkins. Is he interested in your world? Does he like coming to all those fancy parties?
Oh, David just loves people. He gets what he calls a contact high. He loves it. I mean, he doesn't come to everything with me. He comes to the things he wants to come to with me. And he's been really wonderful person to have in my life, and got on incredibly well with Sam.
What about the thorny subject of ageing? You once said it's been a huge help to have been nice-looking but never beautiful. How do you feel about the ageing process, given that you are surrounded by youth and beauty, and that's what, you know, Vogue is mostly? It's about the young, beautiful women.
Well, I mean, I know people think I'm a bit kind of peculiar about this, but it sort of doesn't really bother me. I mean, obviously, you know, I can get up and look in the morning and I can think, this is, you know, this is tragic. You know, got the sacks underneath my eyes. I kind of see sort of, you know, that thing sometimes when you walk into a shop and you see some person in the mirror and you think it's some kind of sad old lady and you realise it's you. You know, I've had those moments, definitely. But in general, I feel quite kind of happy with how I look, and I don't compare myself to the models or the young people in my office. You know what? Maybe it's to do with my mum. I mean, you know, she's 85. She looks incredible. She's never done any kind of procedure. She was never on a diet. And, you know, maybe having a mother around you who, you know, seem to be relatively comfortable with the ageing process themselves possibly helped. I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe it's all going to go terribly wrong soon, but
doesn't sound like it. Time for some music, Alexandra Schulman. We're on your seventh choice of today. What is it?
We Three, Patti Smith. I wrote a novel which is called Can We Still Be Friends? But my working title for it was We Three. And there's a line in this which is, the dice rolls so deceptively for We Three. The song isn't about three friends, but it was sort of what was going on in my head when I was writing it, and it's a great song.
Don't take my hope away from me. You say you want me. I want another baby. You say you wish for me.
We Three, sung by Patti Smith. So, Alexandra Schulman, to what extent are you conscious of people snapping at your heels and wanting your job?
Well, as somebody who was editor of a national newspaper women's page at, I think I was 27, and then editor of GQ at 32 and Vogue at 34, you know, I'm aware that I was really lucky, you know, and it was very much a moment in time where if you were a young woman in London media, there were jobs out there and everybody wanted you. because they wanted to show that they were sort of part of what was happening by having a young woman there. And it's not like that now. And of course, because we all got these jobs quite young, we've all sat there with no intention of moving.
Do you have no intention of moving?
No, not really. No, I've sort of, you know, got my bottom firmly planted in the chair. And actually, I'm really enjoying the fact that the job has become so varied with all of the kind of digital world opening up, but also doing festivals and various other projects. So it's not just about putting together a magazine. So it's kind of endlessly interesting. No, I mean, I guess, you know, they're going to be carrying me out.
In a box. Beautifully lined, I would imagine. I'm going to cast you away to this island, and given that you have done the whole kind of single parent thing and coping on your own, you're a coper. Will you cope on the island?
Yep, I think I will. Although it has to be said that I've never been a particular kind of traveller, desert island person. And there is a quite pertinent story that I remembered, which was when I was 3, I think, and my mum was looking after me for an afternoon, which I hope she will forgive me for saying didn't happen that often at that stage. And she was trying to think what to do with me, and she turned a chair upside down and she put me on it, and she said, imagine now, you know, you're on a ship and over there in the distance, you're standing there, you can see there's a desert island and there's a sign on the desert island. What does that sign say? And I said, no buried treasure here. And I think I feel like that quite about things, you know. I'm not sure that I feel like there'd be that much exciting stuff on the island.
Some music to comfort you, of course, though. So let's listen to your final disc. What's it going to be?
Well, it's Side of the Road by Lucinda Williams, and it very much follows on from A Desert Island, because to my mind this song is all about what it feels like to be alone. I spent quite a lot of time on my own, for which I'm grateful for, and I sort of know what it feels like to be alone.
That was Lucinda Williams and Side of the Road. So, Alex Shulman, it's time to give you the books. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. What else will you take?
Well, I want to take a specific edition of the Penguin Book of Love Poetry. And it's a book that my dad gave me with the inscription, to my darling Alexandra on her 17th birthday, with as much love as is inside Daddy. So I think that would make me happy.
Right, you can certainly have that. And what luxury would you like to take?
This was really hard, but I think in the end I'd like to take an endless supply of Miss Dior Eau de Toilette, because I've been wearing it since a holiday when I fell madly in love, and I just love it, and it always reminds me of that wonderful exhilaration when you fall madly in love.
Of course, an endless supply it is. And one track to save from these 8 that you've chosen today?
It's got to be Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands by Joan Baez, because one, it's incredibly long, so it would go on for longer, and two, it could take me the rest of my life to work out what she's actually talking about.
It's yours. Alexandra Shulman, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.